The meaning of dandelions. From The Secret Language of Plants. By Andrina. Read by Sam Gabriel. Based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Chapter 5. The Fourth Year. Harry had been so sure this would be his year. Even Severus had thought so. The Dementors were gone, and it was just a matter of finding the right moment to abscond. Just leave when no one was watching and go to Remus and Sirius. They would figure out what to do with him. But no one was watching. Ha ha. Cedric Diggory was still Hogwarts's champion and had everyone's wholehearted support. But Harry was quickly becoming everyone's favorite, starting with his broken, "What? No!" when the goblet announced him as the fourth champion, and following with his ardent defense of Diggory, and plea to let him drop out of the competition he hadn't willingly entered to begin with. "You are listening to an object over me," he had cried. "I can't believe it!" He had pressed his face down with his hands as he screamed. It was most entertaining. Crumb's befuddled expression was delightful. So Cedric remained as the official Hogwarts champion, and he was excellent for the role. Handsome, smart, hard-working. Meanwhile, Harry refused to prepare for the trials or give any interviews or pose for photographs, and steadfastly repeated that Cedric was the true champion, and Harry's nomination was merely a clerical error, bound to happen when you let glassware make decisions for you. It was hilarious, to be quite honest. Harry's official photos for the Prophet had to be cropped out so the public would be spared the rude gestures he was doing with his hand. Instead, they got a close-up of his face. The green eyes and raven hair made for a very nice contrast, and many a witch rested her eyes on the picture a little bit before turning the page to stare at the wonderful shots of Crumb and Diggory, who were spectacularly handsome, each in his own style. Minerva McGonagall prepared herself to start handing unreasonably harsh punishments right and left, because she could see that the situation could become ugly very quickly. The picture was everywhere in Hogwarts, and she had noticed that the Creevy brothers had lined all of their books with it. If people decided to make fun of Harry and give him grief over it, she would put a stop to it so fast that she would send them spiraling into last Tuesday. Just the other day in class, Harry had gone and transformed an inkwell into a cabbage, and Minerva was not letting all that improvement in behavior and studies go to waste. Granted, they were supposed to turn a hedgehog into a pincushion, and she was not quite certain what exactly had happened for him to get a cabbage, but it was a good one, not even the color of the ink, except for some traces of blue in the rim of the leaves. So Minerva was quite ready to defend Potter on that aspect with the fierceness of a lion. Only apparently she needn't have worried. She wasn't sure, because the damned picture was everywhere, but apparently Harry's expression of extreme disinterest, the picture almost looked muggled because he wasn't moving, had sparked more humor than derision. Madame Pince complained that somebody kept hanging the picture in the aisles of the library with a text reading, "Potter is not impressed with your work, and you call that an essay." And according to the prefects, most bathroom stalls had the photo, too. Harry Potter judging you while you took a leak. She didn't understand it, but neither did she need to. As long as it didn't cause any more damage to Potter, she was fine with it. You couldn't wish for a better spectacle for the first trial other than dragons. Actual, angry, fire-spitting dragons and four teenagers to fight them. And the champions delivered. They were smart, they were elegant, they were powerful, and they looked good doing it, too. It wasn't enough, however, to satisfy the spectators' thrilling anticipation. It remains to be seen, after those wonderful performances of magic, what Harry Potter would come up with. To see whether the adult wizards would have to rush to his aid as he was burned and devoured by the dragon, or whether the boy who lived had some hidden talent after all. Would he be an embarrassment? Would he be a surprise? Everybody knew Granger had been drilling him for the past week without break. Maybe he would actually manage to catch something before the dragon fell over him. He had pulled the Hungarian Horntail, though, the biggest and fiercest of all dragons. The crowd waited with apprehension as the wizards brought the dragon to the pit. They looked at her horns and the movement of hard muscle and sinew under the skin. There was something mean about the black of the dragon's scales, something sharp and vicious in the curve of her horns, and suddenly it wasn't that funny anymore. They started to regret betting on how many minutes before the adults had to rush to Harry's rescue. Harry stepped onto the arena calmly. Well, he had to be pushed by an anonymous hand, but he didn't look particularly rattled. As usual, he carried his wand strapped to his left forearm because he kept misplacing it otherwise. He didn't draw it immediately, which was unnerving. Instead, he looked at the crowd, the dragon, and the arena with a clean and calm gaze. The whole stadium held its breath when Harry finally took his wand out and held it in the air. There was a murmur as the spectators closest to him relayed the news that they had heard him cast Accio. Accio what, they didn't know. There was the soft flutter of paper against the wind. It was a Yes, it was a magazine. Quick casting of the Eagle Eyes charm revealed it was an issue of Magical Review, so perhaps he was about to cast a particularly complex incantation. Sometimes they featured old and half-forgotten rituals with multiple steps that were incredibly complex to execute. Surely Harry was about to attempt one of those, and he didn't want to risk messing up some part, especially when he had such a bad memory. What a scholarly reaction to the task, who would have known? Probably it was that Granger girl's idea. And yes, he was looking for a sunny spot, because this kind of magic usually relied on celestial influence, and he was sitting because he didn't care. He didn't. He had said so. Harry found a comfortable enough place and prepared to entertain himself for as long as it took for the tribunal to call it quits. He certainly wasn't in a hurry, and it wasn't like he had other things to do. Quidditch had been cancelled this year, and he thought he'd probably done his homework, so he was free to just sit and read. Harry quite enjoyed the journal, even if it was so academic that many things went over his head. They had a habit of featuring different practices of magic, different theories, and Harry liked that. He didn't care for any of the subjects taught at Hogwarts, but there was something oddly charming in these scholarly arguments over what exactly had a Greek wizard meant in his writing 3,000 years ago, or how to identify beyond a doubt the ingredients employed in Aztec potions. It took a while for people to realize that was it. Harry sitting in the sun and reading a magazine, lighter than a book and so easier to accio. The only reason the Weasley twins didn't fall to the floor laughing was that they were leaning on each other. Lee Jordan knocked Angelina Johnson's drink out of her hand he was shaking so hard. Meanwhile, Harry read a paper detailing the evidence in favor of and against a medieval Spanish incantation against dark forces. The British school denied any magic whatsoever, whereas the Spanish scholars said they weren't doing it properly, and that they were probably mispronouncing it, and a rogue Scottish author agreed with them. The main point of contention seems to be the fact that the incantation revolved around drinking a highly alcoholic beverage and singing a song. There was also fire. The drink was supposed to be on fire. Should he show this to Seamus? Basically, they talked a lot about magic without getting to practice it. Harry wondered how come there weren't more squibs studying like this. They could still do research and things like that, even if they didn't possess magical abilities. There was no wand work in spells linguistics. After 10 minutes, the public started to fidget in their seats, and the heads of the judges gathered together in debate. So far, nothing had happened, and it looked like it wouldn't unless someone went and poked the dragon or the champion, as Karkaroff suggested. He volunteered his cane to do it. But then the Hungarian Horntail, who had remained hunched over her nest, rose, spreading her wings and long neck. There was no way anyone could keep talking while a monster of that size moved. She invoked a reverential silence as she pushed her shoulders back. There was a promise of heat and strength. The sun shone over her black hide, bringing deep purple accents and a mark of death between her wings. Harry didn't even glance in her direction. If someone had ever doubted his sorting into Gryffindor, which almost everyone did, it was justified that day when Harry kept reading nonchalantly as a gigantic dragon slowly walked away from her nest and towards him. There was a loud scream when the dragon lowered her head to Harry. Multiple screams. Cups were dropped and flags were clutched. Hermione was gripping Ron's hand so hard his fingers were white. On the other side of the stadium, where the Slytherins sat, someone had left half-moon indents in his own forearm. Harry ignored the rising noise from the bleachers, and so did the dragon. She sniffed at him curiously, and Harry's hair jumped up in the air with her inhalations. After a while, Harry squirmed in his seat and folded the magazine so he could hold it with just one hand. He kept reading it as he absent-mindedly petted the dragon's snout with his left hand. Technically, Harry hadn't gotten the egg. After careful examination of her nest, the Hungarian Horntail noticed the golden egg, sniffed it, and pushed it away with a dismissive flick of her tail. The egg rolled to the center of the arena, well within reach of Harry, who by then had finished his magazine. The whole process had taken almost an hour, but since no eggs had been damaged and Harry didn't suffer any injuries, other than having a dragon's head pressed against his side very much like an affectionate cat, he was still awarded enough points to make it second place, tied with Cedric. Severus was reminded of a small boy playing with a werewolf, fearlessly putting a sock on the beast's muzzle. His forearm itched. So did his hands. If he were certain that he could get away with it, he would take Harry and abscond that very second. Go find Remus and start all over again. The jerk could come too if he must. But he didn't dare. Not if both Dumbledore and he came looking for them. Not while Hogwarts, miserable as it was, remained a safe place against Voldemort. He was coming, he couldn't deny it. He was coming back. The mark was rising like a welt, and Severus didn't know what to do. He started to think that maybe in order to save Harry he would have to stay behind, stay and make sure that neither Dumbledore nor Voldemort could give chase.
Potter, what is...
Draco blinked and shook his head. Have you no shame? You're representing Hogwarts.
Hey, Draco,
Harry waved. I've said it before, Cedric is the true Hogwarts champion.
That's no reason to embarrass the rest of us.
You look very fetching in your robes, Harry pointed out, looking Draco up and down appreciatively. Very nice. Draco was dressed exquisitely, that was no surprise. Harry's robes, on the other hand, were aggressively ugly. They were so hideous it made you wonder how could they not spontaneously self-combust in embarrassment. What was the matter with the frill? There was so much frill and ruffles. Harry's robes had belonged to three different witches of various tastes and body types before being purchased by Mrs. Weasley and adapted to be Ron's formal outfit. The next step had been very simple. Ron still cared about what other people thought. Harry did not. He really, really did not. They traded. Ron resisted at first because it was the polite thing to do, but once Harry got hold of the dress and started to jump on the bed saying, "Mine, mine, mine," he accepted the exchange. His smile had been so soft and wondering, as if Harry had given him the world. Harry felt as if he were trespassing on some religious ceremony, so grateful Ron looked, so easy it had been to make him happy. Harry's robes were green, to bring out his eyes. The color also went very well with Ron's hair, and he looked quite fine. Not as elegant as Draco, for sure, but certainly one of the most handsome students at the ball. Harry could honestly say that he loved his new dress robes, especially the cuffs. Oh, the glorious cuffs with three layers of lace. Harry could say that he loved the robes and all their frilly magnificence, but that wouldn't be completely truthful because what he loved was the effect he had on people. Draco looked personally offended. He mouthed some words silently as he tried to take it all in. Harry wanted to point out that he was going to wrinkle his beautiful robes if he kept clutching at his chest like that.
"I can't believe McGonagall let you go out like that," he said at last.
"Are you crazy? She hasn't seen me yet. That's why I had to leave Gryffindor Tower after I changed."
Harry spent the whole ball playing hide-and-seek with Minerva, who was trying to transform his robes into something that did not fall under the category of monstrosity. Eventually, she managed to corral him in a corner, and Harry's robes were expeditiously turned into something classic, dark, and tragically frillless. To her chagrin, as soon as she turned her back, Fred and George came running, dragging their dates with them, and immediately added some frill back. Sometimes Harry felt as if the twins were the only sane people in the world.
"You should add some moons and stars and planets," Harry's date suggested.
No girl had wanted to go with him. Parvati had said yes and had been his official date for 3 days before she thought better of it and asked to see his robes and whether he knew how to dance. She refused afterwards, and Harry didn't hold it against her. He still needed a partner because the champions were supposed to open the dance, and he knew damn well that if he showed up by himself, they would pair him with someone by force, and it would be even more awkward and boring. Here is where Ginny came by to save the day, when she suggested a friend of hers who, being a third year, could not go unless she got an invitation, and Ginny swore the girl was excellent company. Harry found that he quite liked Luna. At his request, she used her wand to paint over the robes and made some yellow moons and stars, and yes, planets. Saturn with its rings, please. He used to have something like that in the ceiling of his bedroom, and it shone in the dark. Luna sounded very interested by his description. Also, if Harry wasn't a good dancer, no one would be able to tell with Luna by his side. That night, when they were back in their room, Harry took one of the books off of the pile. This year he had been given enough books to form a small pile, and the mere sight of it brought joy to his heart. He had books on Quidditch from Ron and Hermione, and also some classic novels, Severus's, even if there was no name or note, and some theater plays, again no note, but this was Remus, and some random books about motorbikes, owls, and the history of plumbing in London. It had to be serious. Ron was very intrigued about the motorbikes.
"Potter, how are you doing with solving the hint for the second task?" asked Professor Moody.
He was not a bad teacher, certainly knew what he was talking about, but since he didn't hand prizes out like Shacklebolt did, Harry was mostly ignoring him. He had books to read. Still, Harry made an effort to think of an answer, because if the man wasn't nice, he wasn't not nice either. Unfortunately, he had no idea what to say.
"What hint?"
he asked, wondering if perhaps with some indications he could figure out what this conversation was about. Moody focused both eyes, one blue, one bluer, on Harry. Harry's brain immediately found an idea and ran with it, and he had to struggle to at least keep half his attention on the teacher's voice. But really, how could someone whose last name was Moody go and get himself a nickname? Like, who in the world actually decided to call him Mad-Eye? What exactly had he done that made people decide that the weird electric blue eye was more relevant than his general sourness? Moody was still staring. Harry hoped he hadn't missed another question.
The hint, Potter. Hidden in the egg.
There's something inside the egg.
You haven't opened it.
Right,
You haven't,
interrupted Moody. He sounded so surprised, as if he couldn't believe Harry. Harry shook his head no. If he didn't speak, then he didn't have to admit that the egg had been used as a quaffle in improvised broomless Quidditch games in the common room, a doorstop or a backrest, and on one occasion, as a medium for Fred to showcase the extent of his balancing skills. It had certainly not been opened at any point.
I believe Mr. Bagman explained this to you, Moody said.
I am not known for paying attention to people, Harry pointed out, because it was very much the truth. He didn't know what they were expecting. Plus, I don't care all that much about the tenement. Also true. Moody stared some more.
Take the egg and open it underwater and listen to the clue, and then ask for help on how to survive in the water for an hour.
Okay, I will listen to Walter for an hour with the egg.
No, Potter.
All the other champions agreed with Harry. You can't say, but past an hour the prospect's black, too late it's gone, it won't come back, and then claim you didn't mean it seriously. These were the same people that allowed teenagers to fight dragons, mother dragons. Of course they believed them capable of letting the kidnappees drown or be devoured by the water people or whatever. They all thought Harry had exhibited commendable moral fiber and good magical abilities, but mostly he had just taken whatever Neville gave him and remembered Remus's teachings on dealing with creatures. Grindylows were only a problem if you panicked, which Harry did not. Draco had to be a jerk about it, of course, but Harry didn't hold that against him. Draco communicated in taunts and jibes, just as Harry had spoken mostly through fists in his first year.
Come on, Draco, don't be like that. We've taken what you'll sorely miss,
Draco recited, batting his lashes.
Well, he's my best mate, Harry said reasonably.
And Hermione was with Crumb. Besides, they wouldn't risk you drowning, would they? What would your father say? Draco blinked twice, silent, mouth hanging slightly open.
Surely you know I appreciate you, Draco, don't you?
He did. What Draco had done at the custody trial, that was something. And there were all the other little things, like how he still mocked Neville, but he had stopped mentioning his parents after Harry told him to quit it. And he left Ginny well alone without anyone having to say anything. And he made fun of Hermione for being a mudblood, but oddly, not for being a know-it-all. And Hermione resented the second much more. Draco was a bastard, but he wasn't a bad guy, if that made sense. And he was always so surprised. It was kind of fun to give him praise. He looked so perplexed at someone liking him with no further interest or gain.
Okay, so what is that thing?
Asked Draco quickly. More like demanded, actually. But Harry supposed he was in a hurry to change the topic. It's a Walkman.
It doesn't walk. And it doesn't look like a man, Draco shot back. Muggles are stupid.
Some of them are, yes. Come, I'll show you. For all his protests, Draco accepted the earphone Harry was handing him, and then Draco's face. For all the gargoyles in Hogwarts, his face. Wizards had music, of course, but to Harry it felt a bit stiff and almost ossified, like they hadn't done much with music in the last 200 years. They had modern rhythms and groups, but still, to Harry, it felt like most wizards were afraid of experimentation. Harry had made a guess, and it was a good guess. Draco Malfoy approved wholeheartedly of classic Muggle rock and roll. He stood beside Harry until the end of the cassette, and they were both late to their lesson with Moody. Somehow, they started to meet every Tuesday and Thursday for 15 minutes. They never mentioned it, they didn't exchange a word, and it was a wonder how they managed to agree on the time and place nonetheless. But as Harry was coming down from his divination lesson and Draco went to arithmancy, they would sneak behind the statue of a vampire with a billowing cape, and they would listen to music. Harry stayed by the entrance of the labyrinth, waving and wishing good luck to the other champions as they in turn entered the place. He tried accioing something to read, but the place had been warded, and once again they were only allowed to enter with their wands. So it was a bit boring, but at least Harry knew it would be over soon. Until he heard the scream. High, long, a mixture of terror and pain. Harry only hesitated for a second before running in that direction. It took him quite a few twists and turns, but when he found the smoking remains of an acromantula, he knew he was in the right place. Soon after, he found Fleur fighting over half a dozen redcaps. Nasty. One was bad enough. Two or three meant trouble, even for adult, competent wizards. Redcaps in such high numbers. Well, it was a wonder that Fleur was doing so well. They were everywhere, pulling her hair and her skirt and kicking at her legs and punching her stomach to make her fall. And every time they got a good hold, they would bite, and every bite took a bit of your strength. Their hats were crimson red already. Languidus flundus, followed by a blasting hex cast in an arc. That was the proper way to deal with them. But it came to Harry later. What he did was tie up his jacket, throw himself to the floor, and roll. It felt counterintuitive, but it would shake any red caps loose, and with any luck smash them or stun them a bit. Enough that you could stand up and put a reasonable distance between them. They were strong, but they were not that fast. Harry felt like he had always known that, something that predated the memory of the charm Shacklebolt had taught them. Fleur was dazed and pale and incredibly pissed. She was shaking slightly, and Harry guessed it was more indignation than anything else.
"That is not all right, Harry," she said, summoning an iron cage to trap the redcaps. "Nein, Bonnerhus. It's like they want to kill us."
Harry wished her luck and saw her leave fuming. He felt a bit sorry for the next creature she encountered. He tried to make his way back to the entrance, but, well, it was to be expected. He got lost.
"Oh, come on!"
cried Harry when he entered what was undoubtedly the center of the labyrinth. Not fair, not fair. He had gone out of his way to help the other candidates. He had turned back from every encounter, reasoning that if he was finding traps and monsters, he was getting closer, and he still arrived before anyone else. He loitered there for 30 minutes. Cedric hadn't looked so bad. Surely he would make his way there soon. What was a bit of an angry blast at its Scroot, after all? Victory wasn't so sure about, because when he saw him, he had had a haunted look. Murderous eyes, even. Harry had clapped him on the shoulder, asked if he was feeling all right, and then Victor had blinked and looked lost, as if he didn't know how he had gotten there. Harry had recommended he sit for a while until he felt better and even offered to stay with him, but Victor declined. It was getting late, and Harry was hungry. Also, it occurred to Harry that if he was proclaimed champion of the Triwizard Tournament, it would give him a strong argument for his case for early emancipation. 17 seemed an eternity away, and in his experience it barely took 4 months to go to trial. With a bit of luck, he could get himself declared a legal adult before Halloween. He still waited a few more minutes, but no one was coming. The labyrinth had fallen silent. Harry touched the cup. Horrible idea. After touching the cup, Harry had been kidnapped, cut, bled, insulted, and tortured. Oh, God, it hurts so much. And what's worse, he was patronized. They laughed at him. They called him child. They said he was Dumbledore's pet. They were just like the Ministry. They didn't listen. They didn't listen when he said he was not such a big fan of Dumbledore, although this was not the time to explain why, just as they didn't listen when he pointed out that he wasn't even 15 yet. And what exactly was Voldemort trying to prove fighting against him? He was slapped for daring to use his name, and they pushed him into a circle of wizards, his useless wand in his hands to duel against the greatest wizard in the British Isles. Voldemort made him bow when Harry refused to. Would that make it look as though he had entered into this willingly? Would that make it all right for him to duel Harry? Harry had absolutely no chance of winning. He knew that. He accepted that. He didn't even raise his wand. What for? He wasn't surprised when the Avada Kedavra hit him straight in the chest. Sad, of course. Not for himself as much, for the people he would leave behind, and the pain it was going to cause them. Sad for Severus and Remus. His last thought, as he felt the heat of the curse land just over his heart and spread around his chest, was that he had seen this before. That it was ridiculously similar to the green light in Sleeping Beauty, and that he wished he could hug Remus now. Harry fell to the ground, dead. Death was orange in color. It smelled like apricots. You know the feeling. When you wake up while dreaming and you find yourself losing the thread, forgetting, discovering that the things that made so much sense are now perfectly absurd. When you are left with a disconnected image, maybe, and an emotion. Harry woke with a whole world disassembling and turning into nothing, forgetting. He was left with the silhouette of a woman with a big smile and a crying voice. He was left with the certainty that he was loved. He was loved so, so much. The feeling that it was all right. Don't be afraid, Harry. You are very strong. I love you. He wished he could remember her face. Already he was forgetting the sound of her voice. He had, however, the smell of her skin and the sensation of hair brushing his cheek. He was lying face up, his wand loosely held between the fingers of his right hand.
He didn't dare open his eyes. He risked only the shallowest breathing. Voldemort was saying that here lay the boy who lived, and that he had truly conquered life and death. He was power. Harry was trying to remember where the cup had fallen. Should he run towards it or accio it back? No one else had touched it, so it should still work, right? It should still be a portkey. He still hadn't mastered the accio, despite Hermione's relentless training. He could get things to fly towards him, but only if he really wanted them. Otherwise, they simply stayed where they were, which Harry had felt at the time was a perfectly sensible use of magic. You didn't want things flying around at the simplest whim. He really wanted the cup, though. He couldn't believe himself, but he actually wanted to go back to Hogwarts. By the tone of his words, Voldemort would be done preening soon. Harry supposed they wouldn't just leave him there. There would be some light mutilation at the very least before dropping his corpse somewhere public. He should definitely act before that. The ground below him was wet dirt and grass. The tombstones had been claimed by ivy and moss. Not even a bit of sand or dust to kick up and make a cloud in which to hide. Severus knew a charm to make the vines grab you, but Harry didn't remember it, and he probably couldn't do it anyway. Voldemort was now criticizing the Death Eaters that hadn't returned to his call, promising 100 punishments in between dropping unsubtle hints about his followers not having searched for him during those years.
"Not even you, my dear Lucius."
Voldemort had a very peculiar way of speaking. It reminded Harry of someone, but he couldn't figure out who.
"My lord."
There was the rustle of clothes, as if he were kneeling. If I had heard even the faintest rumor, I'd have...
"Run! He is running!"
He was not yet. Harry was getting up quickly and waving his wands to get bluebell flames going. They didn't burn, but it was one of the charms that Harry reliably got right, mostly because he liked the blue cold fire that didn't burn or hurt or did anything, really, except kind of looked like flowers. Dimmer than a lumos, too, the flames were. But they could be spread, and Harry had pointed his wand in a circle so everyone would be blinded for the next few seconds, reduced to blinking to get their night vision back. Enough for Harry to drop down again. In a fight, never cast twice from the same place, Shacklebolt had taught them that, and point his wands to the place where he thought the cup ought to be. The cup jumped to his hands before pronouncing the words, and look at that, it was still a portkey. The day wasn't totally ruined. Everything was a whirl, so Harry kept his mouth closed. Mostly so he wouldn't throw up on top of someone. He knew he had spoken, but very little. He didn't say anything according to Moody, who, as it turned out, was not Moody, but a freaking Death Eater. And because he was tired and his head hurt, and so did his teeth. He had been tortured mere hours ago, but it felt very distant. He didn't say anything to Dumbledore either, other than Voldemort's return. He spoke plenty about that. "Harry, when Voldemort's back..." Harry guessed Severus could not spirit him out of Hogwarts. Now, why did everyone agree that Hogwarts was such a safe place? Harry did not know. It didn't feel safe. Although someone had pressed a hot cup of tea to his hands, and that was very nice. Chocolate milk, like Remus used to prepare him, would have been better, though. But about the other thing, Harry kept silent. He didn't even tell Ron or Hermione or Severus, because he wasn't even telling himself. He didn't acknowledge it until he found himself back at the Dursleys. How? He didn't remember the final exams or the train trip. He could never fall asleep on the first night. He always had the feeling that they were going to come in the middle of the night and drag him down to the closet under the stairs. The only way he could sleep was if he lay by the door, so he would know instantly if someone was trying to open it. He waited until everyone was deep asleep and then tiptoed to the bathroom. The light was glaring and he blinked a bit before he dared to take a look at himself in the mirror. And then he removed his shirt. The curse had hit slightly off-center of his chest, right above the heart. There was a big purple bruise in the entry point, with thin red lines running from it kind of like a river map or the roots and branches of a tree. It covered his chest from below his clavicle to somewhere under his navel. It was eerily beautiful, this mark of death, and Harry couldn't stand the sight of it. That night and for the rest of the week, Harry had a nightmare. This wasn't anything new, because he always had nightmares here and in Hogwarts. The only place where he could sleep decently was in the Burrow. But this nightmare was new, and it terrified Harry like no other. In the nightmare, Harry was again in that graveyard in front of Voldemort. He was pushed inside the circle of Death Eaters, wand in hand, to duel him. But this time was different. This time Harry was dressed in black silk robes, just like him.
The robes were open at the chest, revealing his white skin and the purple tendrils of the new scar, bigger and deeper in the dream, the thin branches twisting their way up Harry's body, until they reached the scar in his forehead. He was pale and marked with purple lines. He had black hair, just like now, tousled and rumpled by the wind. But his face was different. His face was pale and gaunt, 100 times like it had been that summer the Dursleys starved him. The lines around his mouth were hard, and his nose was thin and sharp. His eyes were red, just as Voldemort's. He was his equal, the Dark Lord that would come to take his place, the one so foul that again and again was rejected by death. In the dream, Voldemort didn't die. In the dream, with the logic of dreams, Harry stepped into his body and his place, and all the Death Eaters kneeled before him. There was a new scar on Harry's body, and he couldn't stand the sight of it. He couldn't even think of it. End of chapter 5. For the full text of this and other stories by the same author, visit the AO3 and Tumblr pages of Endrina. First pass editing by Ohana. Music by Sean Johnson. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information found on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. There you can also find all the other stories that I've read, as well as links to my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.